Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Roxy Monroe, who has spent a career applying gamification principles to picture book illustration. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 381 of the podcast with Roxy Monroe. Roxy takes us on a tour of an artist's studio and an armful of classic and modern paintings in her newest picture book titled Masterpiece Mix. Our talk about making art and the role of art in reading and learning is something I really loved, and I've got memories of this conversation in my brain as we begin a new school year. If you know Roxy or her work, you'll already be familiar with the pragmatic charm Roxy applies to her books. And if you don't know her yet, Masterpiece Mix is an excellent place to start. Enjoy the listen. Here's episode number 381 of the podcast with Roxy Monroe. Welcome to the podcast, Roxy Monroe. I'm so glad we get to talk today.
Oh, this is so exciting. Thank you for inviting me.
Roxy, I met you so long ago. Do you remember when we met?
I think we met in person
at
the New York Public Library.
Yes.
When you were at one of Betts Bird's salons, right?
That's right. Yeah, Rocco introduced me to you. We were on a panel of podcasters with Betsy and with Jonathan from the Publishers Weekly podcast, and yeah, it was Katie Davis was there. It was a nice group of people, but I got to meet you and
right.
The other person I met face to face for the first time was Steve Light, a fellow New Yorker.
Oh yeah, sweetheart, yeah.
So
Good since
then, I've been very aware of all of the stuff you do in children's literature beyond just having you in my library. I mentioned before recording that I know of you from so many beautifully illustrated nonfiction books. Why don't I give you a chance to introduce yourself to the people listening, and then I want to jump into talking about all the cool stuff you have going on.
Well, I've been doing nonfiction books for quite a while. I think I've done up to 40 or something. And I've always been an artist, but started writing when I started doing books. And most of my books, as you probably know, use a form of gamification to kind of engage and kind of put a kind of concept or a twist or a device in the books to make the nonfiction more engaging and also collaborative. Kids can work on some of my books together, can read them. So I think that's kind of the type of book I do. And my latest book, as you know, is Masterpiece Mix, which is one of those devices.
Yes, I love the concept of Masterpiece Mix. The idea of walking us through, I mean, it was like this mini author visit in a picture book that we got to visit your studio, but also see that in that you are inspired by and surrounded by such beautiful works that you're able to see those things all around you and be inspired to make your own masterpieces.
Yes, I mean, of course, I went to art school for many years, and when I did Tara's blog, which is, I think you mentioned earlier, I made a little list of the museums I've been to in my life, and it's mind-boggling. I mean, everything from the, of course, all the Washington, London, and, you know, San Francisco, the Kimball in Fort Worth, and the Chicago Art Institute, but also the Prado in Madrid, and the National Gallery in Edinburgh, and the Museum in Tunis, and the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, the Munch Museum in Oslo. So all these years of education and museums and looking at art kind of come together in this book. So I really am very, it's a book very close to my heart. I think you could say that.
How long have you been interested in making art? Is this something that has followed you through childhood?
Absolutely. When I was 6 years old, I think I told you, I know that you live in Maryland, and I grew up in Southern Maryland. At six, I won a countywide first prize for a picture I drew in pastel of a bowl of fruit. And it was in the front page of the what was then the Evening Capital in Annapolis, Maryland. And I'm like, hey, that's cool. Got my picture in the paper.
Yeah, you did get your art. That's
and
amazing.
And like, that was like really an incentive point, I'd say. And my parents always encouraged us to paint and draw. My sister is also a professional artist, makes a living at it, of course. And then I went on to be, you know, art editor of the yearbook, most talented, make all the senior prom, you know, the basic artist. And then went on to various colleges and universities, and then I've never had a job. I've been a freelance artist since forever, other than a waitress job in college. But other than that, I've just kind of been freelancing all my life, which has been a very cool. I was telling you earlier that when I went to when I lived in Washington after graduate school, I started doing editorial illustration for the Associated Press and the Washington Post, those type of publications. But then I started doing television courtroom art for the local CBS affiliate, which is great training for working under pressure, making deadlines, life drawing, and concentrating when all hell is breaking loose. But it was very good training.
How does one get involved in courtroom art? I assume you saw like it advertised in the paper or something that you applied for it, but that just seems like such a weirdly specific thing. I guess what I'm trying to say is you are the first person I have ever met who was a courtroom artist, and yet I grew up seeing that art from watching television shows.
Right. Well, actually, they don't advertise in papers. I mean, you know, it's the TV thing. But what happened was I was watching my little black and white at that time, and I'm like, gosh, I can draw better than that. Plus, I was poor. So I just called the television station, and they said, come in. And, you know, then one day they called about a week later and said, you know, go to this kind of a gruesome trial in Washington at the local courthouse. And I said, sure. So I went there and started drawing and kept getting jobs. Actually, I think my first job was with the Associated Press, and they sent me to a sentencing, which I, being a good girl, I'd never been in a courtroom. So I didn't realize that sentencing is like the last thing in a trial, right? They have the trial that goes on for months, but the sentencing, they just haul the guys in and go, you know, you've got 2 years or 5 years. So I went in there with all my art supplies and sat down and started drawing. And a minute later, they got up and left. And I'm like, what happened? And they're like, well, it was only a sentencing. Anyway, thank goodness they hired me. They gave me a second chance. And then I went on to do that for about 5 or 6 years until I moved to New York.
Okay, so at what point did you feel drawn to children's illustrations and making picture books?
Well, I started going to New York, and the New Yorker magazine started buying my covers.
Okay.
Or they started buying spots, but then when they bought the first cover, I moved straight to New York. I didn't know one person. And I was up in New York trying to get freelance work. And one day I thought, well, based on the New Yorker covers, maybe I can do adult book jackets. So I went to various publishers, and you drop off your portfolio and pick it up a week later, a few days later. And at one point, an editor said, you know, we can't use you, but I have a friend at Dutton Children's Books who might be able to use you. And I'm like, well, I don't do bunnies and bears. I don't do cute. I can't do children's books. But I went to see her, and she liked my work and knew of it because of the New Yorker. And then she said, if you get an idea, come back to me. And a week later, I'm not kidding you, Matthew, I woke up at 7 in the morning, my eyes were closed, and across my vision in the middle of the, you know, was just were these red letters called the Inside Outside Book of New York, because I was so excited about living in this city. And I called her up and I said, hey, Miss, her name was Donna Brooks. Hey, Miss Brooks, I don't have an idea for a book, but I have a title for a book. And I went in and did the book. I didn't even know what the gutter or trim size. I knew nothing. And it went on to win, you know, the New York Times best book and this, that, and the other. And as a result, I'm like, just like when I got that picture in the paper, I'm like, I think I'll keep doing this. So, and I went on and did the series of Inside Outside books. And, you know, yes, that segued into other books.
Yes, yes. Well, I, thinking of the, I don't know how to do this, I don't know where to go next, you have such a beautiful opening in your book that I think is universal for everyone that has ever drawn anything. And so if you don't mind, I'd love to read the opening of your story to that page, and then I'd love to describe that. Is that okay?
Sure, sure.
So your book starts, let me get it in front of me here. Today, I will make a new painting. First, I build the stretcher, then I stretch the canvas, and I put gesso, a white coating on it. I get out all my tools, tubes of oil paint, turpentine, brushes, sketch paper, a palette, and palette knives for mixing colors. But what should I paint? And that picture right there, Roxy, it's to describe for people. It's an over-the-shoulder, the camera is like over-the-shoulder just with this white canvas consuming the page, and on that white canvas is, but what should I paint? And you can see a peek out your window behind with your art supplies in the foreground. I loved that invitation to this story. It made me as a reader feel like, oh, we're on the same page. This is a person that gets where I come from, or where I imagine all of us who like to draw come from.
Or write. I mean, I think I think even more terrifying is the blank paper that, or the blank screen that a writer would start with. At least as an artist, I have the craft in the sense that I'm touching the canvas and I'm engaged, instead of the kind of scary confrontation of the white piece of paper or the white screen.
The blinking cursor is, I don't like that.
What's your first sentence? I mean, it's I think that's terrifying.
Call me Ishmael is the way I start every picture book. Just so I can delete it later. It is terrifying. Yeah. You have a good point that you show us that in this picture book, that you actually have that physical connection to your art before anything is even on that paper, that you're building and stretching out that canvas. There's that appeal, that physical appeal to it, that tactile appeal.
Exactly.
I think is what I'm reaching for.
Exactly. Yeah. By the time you do all this, you do the paintbrushes and all, you've kind of already engaged a little.
Yes.
So it's less intimidating, although it's scary enough. I've often thought the very first line on a canvas, and sometimes I'll put light pencil marks, but basically the first line establishes the whole thing. And once you do a beautiful first line, you know, the game is over. I mean, it becomes easier as time goes on. Now, I mean, not really. I'll say one thing. Occasionally when I'm painting, I remember years ago I had an oil painting, and I knew there was one thing I needed. I couldn't figure out what it was. And I stared at it. At that time, I just had a studio in my home, and I stared at it. I went to bed, and I woke up the next morning, and I knew what to do with it, which is not an uncommon thing with creative people, right? To sleep on things.
I have heard from, gosh, I don't know if it was listening to an episode of Freakonomics podcast or something, that there's something to be said psychologically for leaving tasks undone, because mm-hmm. we work through things, our subconscious mind works through things. So They were saying to be in favor of, as you're saying, leaving a mark on a canvas and walking away from it, not feeling like you need to work to completion before walking away from a task.
Right. And that, and also, if you concentrate too intensely, let's say you have a problem and you're trying to solve it, everyone knows that the best place to solve problems is in the shower, right? When you kind of went or walking, you know, I mean,
yeah. Going for a walk.
You go for a walk because then your mind just kind of get away from the tension of it and it pops into your mind because you've prepared your mind already for it.
Is this something that you have come to understand and accept more and more by doing it? I find that only now am I starting to fully get that my brain really does just want to not have so much stimulation. That when I was mentioning to you before recording that I was out walking my daughter. I have a 2-year-old. I put on like the baby carrier and we just go walk around the neighborhood and she falls asleep on my chest with some white noise playing off my phone. But those walks and the habit of those walks allows me to not think about the walk. So my brain just is free to sort of work out whatever comes to mind. And thank goodness I just like make little notes on my phone. Sometimes I don't even understand what the notes mean in the morning, but something's happening.
Right. And also, as one matures in their work and becomes more confident, you can become more at ease with letting your intuition take over, which is kind of what you're doing. Let, you know, and trust yourself, which I think is super, super important, too.
That's
very exciting.
Trust is something important. I think that that's good. Looking through this book, you have incorporated so many beautiful masterpieces, ones that for me were recognizable and others that were new to me. But what I thought as well, I just thought I'd share this reaction that some of these illustrations or some of these paintings that you've included are ones that I know our students look at and study in art classes, and to see them as well on an artist's studio in your surroundings as you work on your art really brought that connection to me from not just the learning formally in front of a teacher, then also to surrounding yourself by those inspirations and the feelings that you get from looking at them when you're going to make your own art in your own space.
That's right. Creativity is actually a combination of your own knowledge and learning, but then taking it further and kind of combining it and melding it with your own personal, your own personal, your own personal point of view and way of seeing. So you take that's why abstract artists, I was talking to someone today about it. Almost all abstract artists, at least, I mean, nowadays people are 18 years old, they're an abstract artist, but most famous abstract artists like Pollock and Klein and all the 1950s, 60s abstract expressionists all had traditional classical backgrounds, but they became more and more abstract as their work went on. We all have that what they call the foundation courses. It's like learning to read. And so you kind of have to know the rules before you can break the rules.
Yes.
So in this case, you know, these are my favorite paintings from a lot of my courses, but I don't paint like that. I mean, I actually can paint very realistically, but I choose to paint, I have a certain style with the black lines, and you know, it isn't cartoony, but it's a certain graphic style that, you know, I just prefer. It's just, I've developed it over time, regardless of whether I can draw like a super realistic hand or face or something. But all good artists, I think, need this foundation of classical. We work on the backs, on the shoulders of giants, right?
Yes.
It's like science. Science is the same way. We build on them. And that's an okay thing. I mean, it's a wonderful thing.
By knowing what has come before you and by studying and respecting what the masters have done, you're able to find your own voice and expression through that. You're right. Yeah.
Exactly. And by the way, speaking of this book was rejected. I started this book 15 years ago.
No.
And gave it, yeah, gave it, I did a dummy, a very complete dummy, gave it to my editor at Dutton, who had encouraged me to do it. She said, do a book about your work or being an artist. And then it was rejected. And rejection does not particularly bother me. But anyhow, I took this book, threw it in my flat files, and pulled it out a couple years ago and showed it to Mary Cash at Holiday House. And she immediately said, yeah, I want to publish this. But there was the middle section where I have all the artists. In my first iteration, I had all those artists that I used them as examples of techniques like perspective, form, color wheel, tone, value, ant pattern. And they said, you know, they loved the beginning was the same and the end was the same. And I had examples of art such as, you know, classical paintings. But they thought, Grace Macaroon over there, who's brilliant, said, why don't you use, instead of techniques, the paintings showing techniques, have the painting show genres?
Yes.
Like, you know, landscapes.
Portraits. And
yeah.
Yes, and figure
studies. Still lifes.
Yes.
So, and that was the click. It's like, you know, just went off in my, I was like, perfect. That was the key that unlocked the book. And then the other issue, which was a big deal. If you think about it, Matthew, the trade books out right now on artists are almost all of them are biographies. If you think about it, like Frida Kahlo, Jean-Paul Basquiat, you know, they're all biographies. There are very few books that are more kind of universal about art in this kind of more comprehensive way. And you know why? You know why? I'll tell you why. Because we had this issue. I'm sitting there in your office, this is 2 years ago, and Mary's heart sank because we realized that when you deal with museums, it is a nightmare getting permissions. It's very expensive. A lot of them even want to control the typeface and the design of the book. But she thought, well, we could go to the Brooklyn Museum and maybe, you know, pay them. But I thought no insult to the Brooklyn Museum, but there aren't enough famous paintings in the Brooklyn Museum that children will recognize.
Yeah.
And then I somehow found out that I realized that the National Gallery of Art is owned by the people. It's like NOAA, where you can get the photographs of, you know, Jupiter and everything.
Yeah.
And they just had started putting, like about 2 or 3 years ago, they started putting, and now they have 45,000 images, high-res scans. And you don't even have to ask them. Of course, I did ask them, and I went down to Washington for a few days.
Really? I had no idea.
It's new. Yeah, it's brand new.
I see in the back here, I'm just now realizing it. All art images courtesy of the National Gallery of Art in D.C.
Through their open access. And now, I will say one thing, that they're all before 1920 because of the copyright issue. The others are still, so these are all in the public domain. So I was unable to pull, for example, a lot of African-American artists were not collected before 1920. I do have Duncanson, the wonderful still life artist in the book. So there aren't as many women and people of color and that sort of thing that one would want if you're able to access art in the 20th century, right? But I did manage to find some people and also subject matter that works well. But the moment I came back to my editor and said, guess what, I can do this with the National Gallery of Art, which also is free, unlike Museum of Modern Art, which costs $20 to go to.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just wonderful.
It clicked.
And we practically, you know, did a hallelujah.
I mean, really, that to me as an educator is also speaking to not only what we can do with your book and what we can extend in the classroom with using your book, but also in pairing with those 45,000 scans of the art that they have, that's a museum. That's more than they can display.
Oh, totally.
Wow.
So, right, you can go on there and just pull them off. They have three or four sizes, lecture size or print size, and, you know, they're just free to the public.
That's amazing.
Fabulous, fabulous resource.
What a beautiful resource. Well, I was just going to go the direction of complimenting how much. So let me compliment your layout of this book, the way that you you walk us through your studio, and we're seeing art everywhere, and you're talking about it by genre, that sometimes artists paint landscapes or these figure paintings, and we see figure drawings, and we see different artifacts sort of laying about, prints and things on mugs and things like that, calendars, great ways to see that we encounter these works of art everywhere. They become, we perhaps take for granted that these are actually quite famous pieces of art that we just see, you know, hanging in our bathrooms or something like
right.
that.
Right, like American Gothic, you know, the couple, or
yes.
Nighthawks by Hopper. I mean, these have become almost cliches, but they're real
almost
pieces
cliche.
Of art.
They are. But then to have, not only we walk through your studio, but then you create this piece of art that captures all of those pieces that we could study, that gamification piece, to bring it back to that, this last spread that you have. We can study this painting of your neighborhood and see these pieces of art. But then in the back, the very back matter, you've got all 37 pieces of art with annotations that describe the name of the piece and how they were made and a little bit about the artist. And I found that jump off point to be, there was just something there that I thought, this, why hasn't a picture book been packaged this way? You really found a good format, Roxy, to deliver this to those children that are looking at art. I feel like the ways we've engaged it before, at least in books that I've seen in our collections, have been massive collections of art with, you know, like the illustrate or the painting on one side of the page, and then a very, very wordy description on the other, a history of the other. Or, as you've said, they've been biographies of individual artists. So we haven't seen them collected by genre in such a way. So I really commend you for the layout of your book here. Masterpiece Mix has really been thoughtfully presented to the reader. I really think the execution was beautiful.
Oh, thank you so much. There's a review coming out in the Horn book, and I can't put it out because it comes out September 1st, but they said something really cool. They said, Monroe's books are always hard to categorize. And I thought,
thank
and
you.
I love that. I'm like, cool.
Yeah, good to keep them guessing, because you know what?
Yeah.
That makes it that they appeal to that many different readers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just alone, when I have a book that I encounter that makes me as a teacher immediately think, one, I can't wait to give this to another teacher and see how they want to engage with it. But two, I can't wait to consider how I will incorporate this into my instruction with my children. That's a really big deal to have it appeal to an adult in that way, knowing that it's going to appeal to readers in so many different ways as well. So I agree with the Horn book. There is something about you. I think that's what's kept you on my mind. I always liken you to that of other huge names in our collections, like Gail Gibbons, people that are creating those lifelike illustrations for nonfiction stories. But the way that you play with your reader, the way that you are there with them, that you want to engage them. I have to imagine that your author visits are much in the same way, playful like that. But it's just,
I love it that you're
there.
Using the word play, because play is the ultimate way that children kind of learn how to deal with their world. Don't you think?
I think
that play
so.
Is super, super important.
It's not only a fun way to build new understanding, but the lasting understanding that you leave with play will stick with children. When you engage with them that way, they will be asking the same way that we have always been asking for those I Spy books or those Where's Waldo books, because kids just love that they have found something. There's ownership. So when you play with them in a book, they're going to be asking Roxy for this book by saying to me, Mr. Winter, do you have that book where you get to find all of the artwork around the city?
Oh,
even
cool.
though that's just the one spread that they refer to, it's going to leave that impression with them. And then from that artwork, it's going to be the conversation of, do you remember that that piece with the ballerina or with all of the pears in the bowl, it's going to be like that because they've played and they've made meaningful connection to the work. So you know what you're doing and you do it really well. Mm-hmm. Keep going.
Thank you. Well, I will say that my entire Seek and Find and Maze books and this book were kicked in by a fourth grade boy in Connecticut a few years ago. And he was looking at this book, the very first book I did called the Inside Outside Book of New York. And he said, I'd like to ask about the Flatiron Building, which I had a big Flatiron Building, the view looking out, a double page spread, you know, huge. And I said, oh, you mean this one? And he said, no, I mean the other one. And I said, what? And I realized that in the beginning of the book, there I did this huge spread looking out from the Empire State Building. You can see New Jersey and Staten Island and Brooklyn. And right in the gutter, about 3/4 of an inch high, is a little teeny picture of the Flatiron Building. And I had this aha moment when I realized that children see those details and they read pictures and they look at those books so carefully. It just changed my life, that four-year-old boy. He's, you know, a teenager. He's in college by now. But he changed my life. It was just wonderful. Wonderful.
Well, and good for you for listening. I think that's, if anything, I have feeling such a strong connection right now because as a teacher, I've learned how important it is. It's only been from teaching the number of years that I have that I've learned that the one of the most important parts of my job is to listen, not just to speak.
Mm. Yeah. So, yeah.
Good for you for listening. Roxy, I know that you are involved in so many other things. All the other books you're making, the great work you do with Kidlit TV and all the things you do with children's literature at large. Is there anything that I didn't ask you either about Masterpiece Mix or about what you've got going on that you want to share?
Well, I do have a book on rats coming out.
Oh, how?
Quite a tea. No, it isn't really on rats. It's called Rodent Rascals, but it's it has rats in it. But the thing is that I learned, because I did also this book on snakes and bugs.
Yes.
And one little thing I would tell children is that once you learn about something, and this also can be extended to other parts of life,
yeah.
like politics and things, and a lot of issues going on right now. Once you learn about something or you know about, let's say, bugs or rats or mice, then you're not afraid of them anymore. And again, it extends to some things in our society. When we get to know people and know things, our fear goes away and we understand better. So, like, yeah. When I did the book on snakes, like, I'm not afraid of snakes anymore. And I'm not afraid of rats and mice anymore.
It's like they're, you took ownership of it because you
learned. They're trying to live their life just like we are, you know. Yeah. They're just creatures.
So the
book on rats is coming out in February.
In February. Oh, fun.
It's called Rodent Rascals.
To be a person at large, walking around saying how proud you are, I have a book on rats coming out, is really, that's some
right.
New York confidence right there, let me tell you. I love it. Well, it'll be one that I can't wait for our kids to engage with. In addition to Masterpiece Mix, it's going to be a fun school year, and I'm excited for you to get around to schools and for this book to get around to classrooms and art rooms and bedrooms to connect with children. Thank you so much again, Roxy, for coming on. I really appreciated this time with you.
Thank you very much. And there's a line in the book that the artist's dad told her, which is honestly what my father told me as a child, which is to do what you really love. And, you know, this artist loved your neighborhood. She loved great art. She loved making art. And in the end, it combined all three.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a message I'd like to give children, that, you know, just go with your flow, go with your talents. Don't worry about what other people say or what you should do. Just do what you love.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 350 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them, and Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with the books they'll love. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect any ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Rebecca Green shares how to make friends with a ghost. Plus, we invite Emily Arrow for a special song. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep and I'll see you there.